Coming up on KUCB News, Unalaska is zeroing in on a designer for its library renovation, and the local election is just 1 week away. Stay tuned.
Programming on KUCB is made possible by Redfish Electronics. Located in the airport cargo building, Redfish sells computers, Androids, iPhones, iPads, televisions, headphones, and unlocked phones. Business hours can be obtained by calling 359-2205.
Redfish, we got stuff.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM on Alaska. I'm Laura Craigle with some local news on Tuesday, September 25th, 2018. The City Council meets tonight. At the regular session, councilors are expected to approve an engineering firm for Unalaska's library expansion, which is slated for construction next fiscal year. City officials are recommending that councilors award a $163,000 contract to ECI Hire Inc. of Anchorage, the same company that drafted concept designs for the project last year. ECI would be responsible for scoping and pre-design, as well as 30% of the actual design work. Meanwhile, councilors are also scheduled to hear from the State Department of Corrections. DOC officials will present on a proposed work program that would allow selected inmates to work at Unalaska's seafood plants nearing the ends of their sentences. The City Council meets tonight at 6 o'clock at City Hall. Unalaska's municipal election is 1 week away, and to help prepare voters before they head to the polls, KUCB is sharing selections from last week's candidates forum. Today we'll hear from Alejandro Bong Tungal, who's running unopposed for City Council seat F. During the forum, Tungal weighed in on the long-running debate over whether to restructure the Department of Public Safety. He said he supports a proposal by City Manager Thomas E. Thomas to make the fire and police divisions more autonomous.
I don't see much problem between the fire and the police department, but I think it's best if we not really separate the two. It's just pretty much the reporting part of it. We want the fire chief to report directly to the city manager. At the same time, the police chief got a report. I think it'll be a big improvement, and I stand on supporting the city manager on the proposal that he made. And I think the city manager got a good start on making it better for both departments in there.
And so some people like yourself have said that it's going to give the fire chief a direct line to the city manager, and that will be a reporting change that can maybe improve kind of morale with fire or even retention, since the fire chief would have a little bit more control over his department or her department. But other people have suggested that it could be very expensive, that it's more than just reordering city structure, potentially even fire needs its own building. Would that change your opinion at all if it was determined that it would be something that costed some money, even required a new building?
Well, it might, but at present, we're looking at doing some works at the public safety because it's been getting pretty old, the building. Maybe by that time, it can change. But for now, I think everything can stay the same in there. It's just the reporting part is what I'm looking at, so they can have their own, they can stand on their own and run their own department, both police and fire.
So we've seen a lot of different kind of viewpoints come out in this discussion. Hearing different members of the public safety department, fire, dispatch, administration, police, and then different opinions on the council, different opinions within the community. Do you feel like there's enough of a consensus right now to make a final decision?
I think so. We have to make a decision sometime because it's been without any director. I mean, we got our just a temporary for Chip Shockley, a director, but we gotta move forward and finalize because it's been a while So we've been dragging this for so long. I think we got to make a final decision in here sooner than later.
That was City Councilor Alejandro Bongtungle speaking during last week's Candidates Forum, where he also discussed his support for alternative energy projects and Unalaska's plastic bag ban. KUCB will re-air the entire forum tomorrow night, as well as on Saturday and Sunday. You can catch each rebroadcast on Channel 8 TV at 8 p.m. Once again, Tungle is running unopposed for City Council Seat F. Tomorrow, we will hear from Seat G candidate Vincent Tudiakoff Sr. In statewide election news, the campaign of Governor Bill Walker and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott says that a Republican-funded group failed to properly disclose that it bought political TV ads. The campaign filed a complaint today with the Alaska Public Offices Commission. It says the group Families for Alaska's Future, Dunleavy, failed to report ads that the Republican Governors Association bought in Alaska. Walker Mallott campaign manager John Henry Heckendorn says the violations are serious.
Unfortunately, it's not that hard to set up a front group that is nothing but a name on a piece of paper, effectively, to conduct your expenditures on your behalf and then hide all of your donors so no one actually has any idea where the money's really coming from.
The complaint has two counts. The first says that the group failed to register with the commission before spending money, which violates state law. It says the group bought $735,000 in ads with KTUU 2 months before registering and then never reported that money with the commission. Heckendorn says the spending is among the highest in Alaska's history and was done by politically savvy people.
They understand media and campaign disclosure requirements and have just failed to comply with them.
The complaint's second count says the group failed to file accurate spending reports. The Republican Governors Association initially reported that it bought advertising with seven Alaska TV stations. Then it changed the name on its contracts to Families for Alaska's Future, and that group never reported the ads or that it benefited from the Republican Governors Association and its ad buy. Families for Alaska's Future, Dunleavy, could not be reached for comment. The commission could fine that group if it finds a violation occurred. This week, in recognition of National Suicide Prevention Month, we are airing a series from our colleagues at KYUK Public Radio in Bethel. Alaska's Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta has one of the highest suicide rates in the country, and its communities don't get the resources they need to address it. Yesterday, we heard from Anna Bill, a village police officer in Mountain Village, who has responded to dozens of suicide attempts this year. Today, KYUK's Teresa Katsourilis takes a look at one of the things that makes Anna's job so frustrating, the YK Delta's overburdened healthcare system.
It's a little after midnight at Mountain Village's police station, and VPO Anna Bill walks in with a thick stack of papers.
This is just the last couple months.
She's holding a pile of Title 47s. That's a form that law enforcement uses to place involuntary holds on people who pose an immediate threat to themselves or others. Anna fills out a lot of them.
And it's a whole stack.
By Anna's count, over 50 Mountain Village residents have attempted suicide in the past year, and she's worked to save each one of them. As the community's first responder, she's also the first person to decide whether a survivor needs further mental health treatment. She gets on the phone with the Behavioral Health Department at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, the YK Delta's hospital. A clinician performs an assessment by phone or video conference. If a suicide survivor is still at risk, then Anna fills out a Title 47 form, and the patient is flown to Bethel's hospital for further treatment. The problem, Anna says, is that plenty of survivors are sent right back to Mountain Village. She says she's helped save children who've attempted suicide multiple times, some as young as 11 or 12, who were sent home from the hospital the same day they arrived.
But there's another one on her. Four repeats so far on just one person. Five.
That patient is receiving residential treatment now, Anna says, but she thinks she should have gotten that kind of intensive care a lot sooner.
A 15-year-old girl tried five times to commit suicide. Doesn't that scream more than help?
When a suicide survivor is titled, behavioral health workers follow a specific protocol to treat them.
Once they arrive at the hospital, the clock starts.
Jim Sweeney is YKHC's Vice President of Hospital Services. He says behavioral health's clinicians have up to 24 hours to assess whether patients pose an immediate threat to themselves or others. As soon as they don't, Sweeney says that the hospital's legally required to release them, which is one of the reasons suicide survivors fly back to their villages so quickly. But Sweeney says that behavioral health's case managers try to keep track of these patients. They offer them counseling and psychiatric treatment, and they make follow-up calls to see if they need more help.
That happens within a few days after they leave here.
That's the way it's supposed to work. But over the past few months, KYUK has spoken to half a dozen former employees of YKHC's behavioral health department, as well as other healthcare workers who've worked closely with them. All of these sources ask to remain anonymous. They said that suicide survivors rarely receive the follow-up care they need. One former behavioral health employee said that over 90% of patients never receive a follow-up call from the department's case managers or intake coordinator. Another said that patients routinely tell them they, quote, just never heard back from the behavioral health department. When KYUK asked Jim Sweeney about this, he said he's never seen that happen.
Could it happen? Sure. We're a human system. When we hear about it, when we know about it, we reach out to that person and we make sure that it's not happening again. But I think a lot of times it's rumor, it's innuendo, it's very hard to fight a negative like that.
Former behavioral health employees also said that suicide survivors and other patients aren't required to schedule follow-up appointments before the hospital releases them, which Sweeney confirmed. That just isn't allowed at other hospitals, like North Star or the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Ron Hale is the CEO of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, and he says that Medicare and Medicaid require his staff to schedule follow-up appointments with patients before they can be released.
And it's just, to be honest with you, it's just good patient care.
And if you live in the villages, it can also be hard to schedule any follow-up appointments in the first place. YKHC's Jim Sweeney says that about 50% of patients who pass through behavioral health decide against doing any follow-up treatment, and behavioral health's clinicians are seriously understaffed.
It's a different life out here, and sometimes it just isn't what they expected it to be, and they don't stay with us.
YKHC is trying to fix this. They're constantly hiring and expanding, and its new facility will include more beds for cases like these. The hospital is trying to provide holistic mental health care to a remote region the size of Oregon, and that involves a lot of challenges that are out of YKHC's control. For instance, Sweeney says the hospital regularly refers patients to state hospitals for further treatment, but there's often no place to put them.
Just a statewide shortage of beds for people like that. It does happen regularly.
The Alaska Psychiatric Institute is one of those hospitals. CEO Ron Hale freely admits that his organization struggles to retain a large enough staff to care for its patients.
In order for me to provide safe staffing to the hospital, I've actually closed down 22 beds.
According to Allison Kulas, the executive director of the State Suicide Prevention Council, this all comes down to the state's budget.
I think that's a huge issue. A lot of times it does come down to funding. And I think we're in challenging times here.
In the meantime, first responders in the YK Delta's villages are doing what they can. Annabelle tells me about one woman whose life she saved a few times this year.
I go pick her up. She comes in. She gets titled. I send her off. She comes back that same day or that next day, that next week or the week after. She's attempted again. So I go back and pick her up, retitle her, resend her off. She comes back again.
In the face of all of these obstacles, Anna says, communities need to do what they can to care for suicide survivors themselves. In tomorrow's episode, we'll explore how Mountain Village is trying to do that. Reporting in Mountain Village, I'm Teresa Kotsarilis.
That story was part two of a four-part series on suicide and treatment in Mountain Village. If you or one of your loved ones is struggling with suicidal thoughts, please call the Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255 or call USAFE at 581-1500. This week, Unalaskans Against Sexual Assault and Family Violence is hosting its annual Make a Difference Dinner for suicide prevention and awareness. The free community event is billed as an evening of sharing and inspiration. It starts Thursday at 6 p.m. at the high school. And that's the news from Unalaska. I'm Laura Craigle, and you're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. Find us online at kucb.org, and please stay tuned for your local and marine weather forecasts.